This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. This past Sunday, July 11th, thousands of Cubans in dozens of cities around the island nation took to the streets to protest the country's communist dictatorship and persistent shortages in food, energy, and medicine, all of which have been made worse by the pandemic. These are the biggest anti-government demonstrations in Cuba in decades, and the size and scope of them are suggesting parallels to the Arab Spring from a decade ago. The demonstrations have been enabled by social media and the internet, which only came to Cuba in a big way in late 2018, when President Miguel Díaz-Canel allowed citizens access to data plans on their cell phones. To better understand exactly how Facebook, YouTube, WhatsApp, and other social media platforms are connecting the Cuban people and undermining state control, I spoke with Ted Henkin, who teaches sociology and Latin American studies at City University of New York's Baruch College. He's also the co-editor of the collection Cuba's Digital Revolution, and we talk about the near-term, mid-term, and long-term implications of the recent protests, how the United States should respond, and the potential and limits of the internet when it comes to challenging an authoritarian government that has held power for over 60 years. Here is The Reason Interview with Ted Henkin. Ted Henkin, thanks for talking to Reason. And the first question I'm going to ask is, how is the internet enabling what's going on in Cuba?
Yeah, okay. I think it's important to start with what's not happening. And that is important because we tend to read foreign developments as they relate to the internet shallowly. And examples of that happened a lot with the Arab Spring and calling those things Twitter or Facebook revolutions. And I think what's important to understand in that sense in general, and then Cuba specifically, is that the internet is acting as a facilitator of interests and groups and protests and discontent that traditionally were silenced and didn't have any place or channel where they could really express themselves. So they're not internet revolutions. I think it's important to call those internet-enabled uprisings or protest movements, right? There's an old concept called the dictator's dilemma, which is any technology that may enter an authoritarian system as a double-edged sword and could help the dictator rule, maybe legitimize the dictator or the authoritarian leader because of education or development or, you know, any kind of other things that this technology, in this case, the internet, enables. But it's a double-edged sword in that it can be used for a lot of other means by other actors. And this is certainly the case in Cuba. And so that dictator's dilemma, although sometimes it was read from a perspective of technological determination. You know, whenever internet enters a society, game over. And while Ghonim, the former Facebook executive who was Egyptian, you know, regretted his overly rosy idea that you add internet and the regime is over. And he learned the hard way that yes, the internet and social media is useful and helpful to undermine monopoly control of media communications and other aspects that are fundamentally important for totalitarian systems, whether of the right or the left. But they don't declare a winner. They change the game in important ways. And
can you take a step back and explain why? How did the internet come to Cuba?
Yeah.
You've written about how in December 2018, you know, basically data plans were allowed for phone service or 3G mobile. Why did that happen?
Well, that's a head scratcher because, and it goes back to the dictator's dilemma. I mean, before right. that, you basically have a period in the 90s when Cuba was actually pretty advanced in the region, in Latin America and the Caribbean, in terms of its networking and internet and that kind of thing. But Fidel and the leaders at that time realized that this could be they called it a wild cult that needed to be tamed, right? And they saw it as a mortal threat because it undermined monopoly information control, which is one of the fundamental hallmarks of the Cuban system. The mass media is propaganda in Cuba. There's no two ways about it, and almost everyone, right or left, who understands and studies Cuba would grant that. And so the internet, in that sense, you know, has a revolutionary, or you could say a counter-revolutionary potential. But because of underdevelopment, because of priorities, and because of that fear, and you could even add because of the U.S. embargo, isolating and cutting Cuba off from these kinds of communication influences, technologies, because it was part of the overall embargo, Cuba isolated itself and was isolated. That gradually ended when Raul Castro became president in 2008. And gradually thereafter, Cubans started getting gradually, but very gradually online. They started getting cell phones. They started to be able to buy and use laptop computers. And so internet then grew from about, you know, 3% connectivity in about 2008 to around 2015 or so, you went up to about 15 or 20%. And that was enabled partly by the government rollout of first these very few internet cafes, and then they kind of grew across the island to about 1,000 of them. Then the next big thing was that Cubans got what are called Wi-Fi hotspots. And these were set up largely in public parks throughout the island. And that was the kind of main way, the pioneering way that Cubans got online, you know, between about 2015 and 2018. Together with that, Cubans could contract to get home internet access. And all of these were kind of ways that Cubans were getting online gradually. During this period was the heyday of the blogosphere in Cuba, and many independent voices established themselves, became even well-known outside of Cuba, not so much inside of Cuba, by being bloggers. Yoani Sanchez is the most well-known, but there was a whole community, and she was the tip of that iceberg. But because internet connectivity grew, and because the usefulness of a blog is largely about airing an opinion, or an analysis, but not really communicating reliable information. You know, Cuba is awash in opinions, and Cubans are really good at airing them, even with or within their system. But what they don't have is access to reliable information. What they have is access to government propaganda, partisan propaganda from the Communist Party. And so what they really needed was reliable journalism, the facts, reporting, information. And so starting around 2014 up until today, you've seen the new kind of wave was independent digital journalism, media startups, basically digital newspapers and magazines. And that was fascinating because the bloggers were largely self-taught and opinionators, right? Pundits, and very many of them, the leading ones, were often very critical voices. Because that was what was missing, right? But many of the people who founded these independent websites and newspapers were actually trained as journalists in Cuba at Cuban universities, did their social service with their teeth clenched tightly, survived that 1 or 2 year commitment that they had to give back to the system. And then they never wanted to work with the official media again and started independent startups, but they didn't want to become dissidents. But of course, they were targeted because they started independent websites as enemies, and interrogated and detained and defamed. And so all of this was the kind of the groundwork that was laid. And then in December of 2018, the government opened up the possibility for people to get mobile internet. Why did they do that? Well, I think they did that for two main reasons. Number one, there was an accumulated demand that the whole world has internet. And we're supposedly in a computerization of society program. The government has a policy they call the informatización de la sociedad, which is somewhat of a joke, but it is true that access has grown, prices have dropped, and the ways and means of access have grown. right? But Cuba is still a far cry from most of its neighbors, and especially places like either China or the United States in terms of access. However, that became a before and after moment because it allowed access to the internet to become now an anywhere, anytime, real-time phenomenon, and not something that was restricted to a limited amount of time in a public park under the hot sun, and you could only really do text or maybe film yourself talking, but you couldn't show people what was happening in real time. And as we saw on Sunday, that's a key distinction, because what really sparked the spread of this protest across the island was people filming live on Facebook and broadcasting that, and then other people in Cuba seeing those things broadcast in the next town over did it themselves. So why did the government do that? Because of accumulated pressure and demand. But the other reason it did it, Cuba is in constant economic crisis, right? It's inefficient, it's unproductive. The system is totally lacking in incentive structures. Private sector is got 1,001 obstacles in its way. And so the government sees the internet access as a cash cow because it is the sole internet provider through its telecom monopoly, Nauta. Etexa is the system, is the company, and Nauta is the particular service where you get mobile data. And so, but it was a Pandora's box that they were opening, because it's become the political headaches. Probably now they can look back and say have outweighed the economic windfall.
And you've taught, or you've written, your Twitter feed is filled with these images from cell phones. The demonstrations are, you know, vast, right? I mean, they're not just happening in Havana or a couple of cities.
Exactly.
They're all over the place.
Yeah, this is what's unprecedented about them, is that even if one of these had happened, it would be quite surprising in Cuba. But the fact that they happen simultaneously in probably between 30 and 50 places around the country is amazing.
What are the, besides Facebook Live, or kind of a video that's being shown via phone or Facebook, what are the other apps? Like, what are the ways in which people are using the internet to either protest or represent and share images of protest?
Yeah, well, I guess you could say, can you kind of break the apps that Cubans use in terms of what we're talking about into two groups? Ones that allow horizontal encrypted private communication, and others that are broadcast media, right? So Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter are the go-to apps to broadcast or to share with the world or with a wide public what's going on, including a live broadcast. In Cuba, they even have a word that they've been kind of invented. For Facebook Live, they don't call it Facebook Live. They call it una directa, because it's a transmisión directa al público, right? It's a direct transmission to the public, whoever's watching. And people who might be well-known because they do these things, you know, might announce, you know, in 5 minutes, I'm going to be doing a directa. Stay tuned. And then they're out in the street talking to people or showing some abuse by the police or whatever. A fourth channel is, of course, YouTube, right? And there's a whole group of Cuban influencers and YouTubers. And actually, interestingly enough, President Díaz-Canel angrily gave YouTube an endorsement on Sunday when he blamed this on these irresponsible, mercenary YouTubers and influencers. It was almost laughable that he was blaming this on YouTubers and influencers, right?
Yeah.
But that shows really that this is broken through and made the government.
That's pretty gutsy, though. I mean, if you're doing something from Facebook or YouTube, you are totally public. I mean,
yes.
The government knows exactly who you are, and they can kind of trace you down.
Well, exactly. And so that's been a change over the last, let's say, 15 years, is that, and this is one of the things they were chanting in the street on Sunday, we're not afraid. No tenemos miedo. And this is a key part of the control in Cuba, is keeping people afraid, keeping them isolated from one another and not realizing that other people share their concerns or their complaints, and keeping them afraid of sticking their head up and getting it chopped off. And the internet has helped mitigate both of those, because they see other people who share their concerns, and then that helps them lose their fear. But there's always been, in Cuban history, the last 62 years under the revolution, people who are brave enough to do that. And those people have grown, especially over the generations. And so there's a lot of people who are out of the political closet, so to speak, in Cuba, who say the same thing in public as that they would say in private. But there's a long tradition in Cuba of what they call a doble moral, or a duplicitousness that you practice strategically for survival, because only among your family and friends are you going to trusted ones, are you going to be critical, because there's a whole network of what they call chivatos, or spies, or people, tattletales, who will report back. And many people who are interrogated the first time, they're offered that deal, like, okay, you can keep doing this, but you have to report back to us. You have to work for us, right? I know a number, and I've interviewed a number of independent journalists in Cuba who had exactly that speech, right?
What are the private app, or, you know, the encrypted apps, or the peer-to-peer apps that are being, I mean, is Signal or other types of, you know, communication systems at work here as well?
There's four or five or six of them, but four that I'll mention here because they seem to be the ones that people trust the most and have gone to the most. I think what started as kind of an evolutionary process, people, because they were on Facebook first and because everyone they knew was on Facebook, it was easy to use Facebook Messenger because you're like already on Facebook. You see that little lightning bolt and you go and you send a private message, a direct message, a DM, you DM somebody. But people realized and learned the hard way maybe was that that's not encrypted and that can easily be hacked. Or if someone gets interrogated and someone gets a hold of your account, you know, that stuff can get out. So they migrated from Facebook Messenger to WhatsApp. And WhatsApp is used in 1,000 inventive ways. I mean, we might see WhatsApp because we have other options as mainly this or that. You know, we use it in the United States or in the West for these reasons. But in Cuba, they use it for a cornucopia of different things. A lot of the independent startup media sites use it as a way to broadcast their information. They put a daily digest with links on WhatsApp. Then WhatsApp, even though it's encrypted, was questioned because it wasn't encrypted enough. And so people then started migrating to Telegram and to Signal. There's even a couple of apps that are Cuban engineered or Cuban developed that are for that kind of thing. But because they're designed and in some sense approved by the Cuban government, people don't trust them for real private communication. So that's the kind of situation there. Now, after December and 2018, things heated up because you had all of this, you know, prologue and context, and then suddenly people had access to horizontal real-time communication through mobile internet. And so in the 2.5 years since then, culminating in Sunday's protests, you had this nonstop drumbeat of every month or two, you would have some major mobilization that was a kind of a hashtag social media enabled and internet enabled protest, mobilization, call to people to do things, starting with a tornado that hit Havana in January of 2019. There was also this campaign on social media to get people to vote against the Constitution or to abstain from voting on it. There was an LGBT, the kind of official LGBT march that was scheduled, was canceled the last minute without any clear reason. So people organized an independent one online, and then they went into the street and marched, and then they were repressed. That was actually very similar to what we saw on Sunday, except it was just in one street in Havana. But people marched through, and it wasn't political. It was about LGBT, but... Right. It was independent, and so they shut it down, and they dragged people off. And all of that led to the November of 2020 sit-in outside the Ministry of Culture in response to a government raid of a hunger strike that was happening on the 26th of November. On the 27th, a bunch of mainstream, mostly young artists and intellectuals literally crowded and sat down outside the Ministry of Culture demanding answers from the government about repression of people for either free speech or artistic freedoms, and really the right to have rights in and of themselves. That gave birth to a kind of new dynamic, because it was really an unprecedented taking of public space. And as we learned again on Sunday when Díaz-Canel spoke, la calle es de los revolucionarios. The street belongs to the revolutionaries. That is an old saying. Public space is understood to be revolutionary space, and it can't be used in ways that are critical or counter to the revolution. At least that's the rule.
Mm-hmm.
Unwritten, but certainly spoken and reminded. And they also say la universidad es de los revolucionarios. The university is for revolutionaries. And that began to be challenged. The street wasn't for the revolutionaries only. There's people in Cuba who are either non or counter-revolutionary. And then the final thing I think that was really important is this thing called Movimiento San Isidro. This is part of what we saw in November. A group of artists, mostly marginalized artists from humble backgrounds and poor neighborhoods in Old Havana, they had been doing political art, street art, for a few years, again protesting against some new legislation that was rigidly controlling of the independent artist sphere in Cuba. And they had kind of been a sideshow in terms of media attention, in terms of government repression, but because their hunger strike was cracked down on, it was filmed on a cell phone, it was shared and spread across Cuba, that led to this 500 people or so to turn up and sit in at the Ministry of Culture. So that movement has continued to be a kind of source, and that neighborhood, a source of protest. And because that's a poor, mostly Afro-Cuban neighborhood, it really stings the government, because a part of its legitimacy comes from the claim that it has been in favor of and supporting the least of these, the marginalized, the traditionally discriminated against. But those people in that movement, together with some Afro-Cuban musical artists and celebrities who live now mostly in Miami, all of whom are Afro-descendant, they decided to record a music video called Patria y Vida. And this was in late January, early February. And that just became a viral, you heard it all over the island. And that's what that's the other main chant that people had when they were out in the street. Patria y Vida, homeland and life, right? Fatherland or homeland and life, right? That is a retort directly. If you're Cuban, you get it automatically, because Fidel Castro used to end all of his speeches with this boilerplate declaration. He would say, "Fatherland or death, we shall overcome," right? We will be victorious. Patria o muerte. So you got a choice between homeland or death, or you have to give your life for the homeland. You know, you can interpret it different ways.
Right.
Venceremos. And so this was saying that essentially that government line is divisive. It basically turns us into revolutionaries and counter-revolutionaries, Cubans and traitors, and we need to unify and we need to celebrate life and not like promise death if we're not like in line. And the video became extremely popular. There were a number of other protests that happened in March, April, May, where people sang that song or chanted that chant, but they were localized in Old Havana. And I think it took scarcity of medicine, scarcity of food, and a spike in COVID cases and deaths in the last, let's say, month in Cuba for it to turn into what we saw on Sunday.
How did these protests compare to the protests in 1994 in Cuba, which seem to be the reference point that people are comparing to?
Well, I would say that in most aspects, these are very different protests. It's the reference point because there has been very few public protests in Cuban history under the revolution. This has been a very rare occurrence. And those protests are different. I mean, so in that sense, they're similar, right? They're kind of a breakthrough moment of protest. But the government got very quickly control of those. They were localized to one part of Havana. They didn't last very long. And they were largely the result of the misery that Cuba was going through after the fall of the Soviet Union, when exports and imports and food and fuel, everything dried up, and people were getting on rafts and leaving the country. Fidel Castro himself actually went out into the street and helped to quell the protests, right? But they were, you know, poor, marginalized, mostly male, probably a good portion Afro-Cuban people who were protesting, but maybe more rioting, breaking things, right? It was more of a frustration. This protest is different, it seems to me, in that it is pointedly political and anti. It's not just breaking things. It is demanding freedom. It is saying we are not afraid. The other big, big difference, of course, is that this is happening in 30 to 50 locations, cities and towns all over the island. And then the final difference, which is probably the key one, is that this is happening in the digital age, right? And this is happening when people have in their pockets, in their hands, cell phones. And the cell phone is a real game changer in terms of how these dynamics work, because they allow, I mean, you would look at any of those pictures and 2/3 of the people are filming or holding up cell phones. And you're obviously seeing it because someone is filming it, and you're seeing it because someone had a cell phone. So you don't have to rely on the Cuban media, which is totally unreliable. You don't have to rely on the foreign media, the foreign correspondents, because they're often muzzled, controlled, or can only say so much, or they'll be sent packing very soon. These are citizens or independent journalists who are filming. And so that's why for the past 2 days that we've, you know, since Sunday, the government shut off the internet, because they know that helps spread the discontent and the virus of protest, is seeing other people protest or seeing them get it clubbed in the head, right?
One of the, you know, hallmarks of kind of contemporary, you know, internet age protests is that they're distributed. You know, people have cell phones, people upload footage, images, etc. In the Arab Spring, you know, a decade or so ago, we saw similar images and similar activity. It didn't really come to much in terms of transformative change in the countries most affected by it. What do you think, what are the lessons from the Arab Spring that might end up kind of shedding light on what's going on in Cuba and where it's going to end up?
Yeah. Well, I would, three names come to mind of people who have experienced and then written about this in I think smart ways. The first is a guy named, almost everyone knows, is Malcolm Gladwell. He had a New Yorker article about a decade ago, was commenting on this. And he was kind of poo-pooing the Twitter revolution, because he argued, based on research that has been done, that this is based on weak ties. It's very good at mobilizing people, but it's very bad at capitalizing on that mobilization, because those people have very little invested and very little authority or structure or organization to turn discontent, even protest in the streets, into something that could potentially replace or challenge a government. So also Wael Ghanim, the Egyptian Facebook executive who started that Facebook group that, you know, helped bring down the Egyptian government, he was very, let's say, optimistic that you just need an internet, right? And that will help you change things and get rid of authoritarian leaders. But later on, he has this TED Talk where he basically says, I was wrong, because, you know, as we've learned in the West in recent years, right, fake news, amateurism can't replace journalism, right? Meaning that you don't know if it's on the internet, if it's true. The government then knows that, so it floods the internet with unverifiable claims. So everybody can play that game and it doesn't get you anywhere. Also, short messages on Facebook or Twitter tend to not leave room for reflection, thought. There's more like a got you. There's a distinction between calling someone out and calling them in, right? Calling them out is kind of exposing them publicly to shame, which doesn't really help build consensus or learn lessons or move together forward. It's just embarrassing or humiliating somebody. Calling them in would be, you know, reaching out to them in private and saying, hey, you know, I disagree with you for these reasons. Let's have coffee and talk, right?
Right.
But it's more of a gotcha game. And so he learned the hard way that the internet is really good at certain things that can help undermine or tear down things, but it's not good at building things because it's a distributed network without a central authority structure. And Gladwell actually compared that to the civil rights movement and Greensboro back in the 50s and 60s, where you had this structure that was born either out of the Black church in the South or out of the historically Black colleges and universities. And that's where the backbone of people who were willing to, those are strong ties, right? And so right. That distinction is important. A final person is a sociology professor in the U.S. She's of Turkish origin. Her name is, I say Zeynep Tufekci, is probably saying it wrong, but she's a brilliant public intellectual and has a whole book called Twitter and Tear Gas about this dynamic. And she certainly recognizes the power of the internet, but she also talks about networked authoritarianism and how governments can play this game, muddy the waters, and they can easily make accessible information unusable because we don't know what to trust or believe. And then, of course, they do have a master switch that they can turn off and on.
Right. And what is the role? I mean, this was certainly the case in Egypt, where it was relatively, maybe not relatively easy, but it was one thing to tear down a government or a secular government and a president, but then the army really is calling a lot of the shots in a country like Egypt. And that also seems to be true in Cuba, so that you have the government, but then there's, the guys with guns and tanks who are controlling things. How do they fit into the equation of, like, what do we look for to see where this is heading in Cuba?
Yes. Well, I think in that sense, it's kind of it's a bleak situation because, remember, Raul Castro, Fidel Castro's younger brother, the former president of Cuba, who just retired a few years ago from president and then retired a few months ago as the head of the Communist Party. For his whole career, he was the head of the armed forces. He was the minister of armed forces. He built the armed forces. He put everybody who's in the armed forces in the places that they are. The armed forces also controls a big parts of the Cuban economy. A lot of the armed forces generals went to business school in the 90s through a program and were put in places to run different parts of the economy. And so there's a lot that those people have in terms of power and a lot they have to lose if the regime changes, economically, especially, right? And so there's going to be, the police are seen by people generally, and especially the secret police, the state security system, the Ministry of the Interior, are seen as the bad guys. But I think that the power behind them is the military. But the military isn't traditionally seen as a bad or evil or repressive organization because they have mandatory military service for males in Cuba. And so people have a familiarity with it as something normal, whereas they see police and especially the state security as the kind of henchmen of repression. But I don't know how true that is an actual fact. It's just a good cop, bad cop, maybe routine. And so the other thing is that even though Raul Castro is old and officially retired and has no official portfolio, he certainly has moral authority among the people who are in power, including the president, but also everyone else behind and beneath and around the president. And you have the government, you have the military, you have the Ministry of the Interior, but then you also have the party. But traditionally, Fidel was really in control of all those organizations, and then that was passed to Raul. One thing to watch, however, of course, is that when popular discontent overflows and expresses itself in these popular protests and street marches and et cetera, what does the middle class do in terms of which side does it join? People who might be celebrities or people who have something to lose, but also maybe a lot to gain for a change. But then what elements within the governing structure might get peeled off or split and side with the protesters in one way or another, or will they just obey orders? And so that question is too early to ask or even answer, but it's something that I think we would be watching for in the days and weeks to come.
What, you know, everyone in the United States, if you're on the left, if you're on the right, if you're libertarian, whatever, you know, people are going to project onto Cuba, you know, their ideology. So, you know, how do we disentangle that? And is it, I mean, is this fundamentally, it's a Cuban phenomenon, right? And is it going to mostly be resolved, you know, within Cuba? Or what are the, you know, if this was happening pre-91, it would, you know, there would be a superpower overlay on all of this. But, you know, how do we disentangle, you know, American ideology from what's actually going on?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, I think that, yeah, it is hard to see Cuba because all of us have blinders or lenses or tinted glasses, depending on mm-hmm. what we see. I have a friend in Cuba who would host delegations. He's a journalist there, and he would often host delegations. And he said, whenever they had people from the third world, developing world, they would always ask about healthcare and education. And whenever they had people from Europe or the United States, they would always ask about, you know, human rights and democracy, right? And so that's certainly true. The United States, Cubans, Americans, you know, on the left, they tend to do the same thing as people in the third world, and on the right, the same thing as, you know. But I think there's also a projection, and Cuba's been really good at playing this role, at seeing Cuba as a David and the United States as a Goliath, and reading everything through the embargo and the U.S. imperial relation. And if you're a student of Cuban history, there's certainly reason for that frame. But the problem is that many people stop reading Cuban history after 1959, or I only read it up to 59, because after that time, gradually and then definitely by the mid 60s or late 60s, you know, there's a Goliath of the Cuban government and the David of the Cuban people, right? And so it's important mm-hmm. to see that Cuba is not one thing, it's many things. And there's certainly a divide between state and society, right? Where the state, of course, claims to legitimately represent and serve the people. But that's not true in any country, but it's especially not true in a country that lacks a whole range of fundamental freedoms and civil liberties, right? And just because they have access to these other things like healthcare and education for free, and for a time it was even quality for free, but not anymore really, that doesn't make it okay then to not have the other freedoms, right? So I think what's most important, and this is hard for Americans to do, or any outsider to do, is to try to tune in to the various different perspectives that are coming from within Cuba that are, let's say, unfiltered by propaganda, right? I mean, everyone has different opinions or takes, but if you have a system or a party that is editing or censoring or turning what you do or say into propaganda, then it's really hard to hear voices. So I try, because, you know, I you know, half my life is lived in Spanish. I try to listen very intently to the nuances that Cubans themselves are mm-hmm. sharing and reporting. But it's hard for Americans to do that because we get an American English version, and is often watered down, and it's just maybe a headline or breaking news. I think that my advice would be this: when people present Cuba as one or the other, I say it's both and, right? When people present it as this revolutionary society that stood up to Uncle Sam and successfully resisted globalization and imperialism and capitalism, I say yes. And when people, you know, but it's also these other things that you could find in George Orwell, Animal Farm. I mean, I reread Animal Farm recently, and I was like, I could have read this 20 years ago and I would have understood Cuba. Not totally true, but all of the stuff that's in Animal Farm exists in Cuba, even though they also stood up against a Goliath, an imperial power that was ignorant and arrogant in its policy, and continues to be so largely, especially under Trump, but even remnants of that under Obama and Biden. But at the same time, that shouldn't silence us or cause us to bite our tongue when it's very clear that people are out in the street chanting liberty, right? Give me liberty or give me death. I mean, they're saying give me liberty and give me life, right? And we're not afraid, they're certainly not complaining about the U.S. embargo. They probably did that last week at a government-sponsored protest. So I think that it's hard, but very important to keep two contradictory ideas in your mind at the same time, and even see them not as contradictory. They both can be true at the same time, right?
Is there anything that the United States, which obviously has a long and generally awful relationship with Cuba, in terms of, you know, trying to dictate terms to that country, you know, is there anything that the U.S. can be doing that would help facilitate a, you know, a flourishing of actual kind of civil society and freedom within Cuba? Or is it something where, you know, whatever we do is going to end up making the situation worse?
Well, I think the first thing that we should do is recognize that we can't do very much, right? And that whatever we do may or may not have a positive or negative effect, that these things are largely out of our control, possibly by our own fault, given history and that. However, I think that most of the moves that Obama made were moves that are borne out by logic, reason, and history. The things that we tried in various ways over 50 years didn't work. It didn't liberate Cuba. If anything, it gave the government a convenient excuse, a Goliath to blame its problems on. And that's not even to talk about the, you know, ethical or human rights issues of the kind of embargo we had. I'm not completely against, you know, sanctions or embargoes, but they need to be targeted. They need to be focused. And they need to be.
Clearly not effective. If the idea was to destabilize the Castro regime, a complete failure.
Right. So, what Obama did, I thought, was to continue to rhetorically celebrate and stand up for a classic liberal freedoms rights, and he did that not just in an op-ed or in a White House briefing. He went to Havana and he gave a speech to the president and people of Cuba, and he said those things explicitly, unapologetically, respectfully. He also recognized other things that were that Cubans could be proud of, that Cubans had in common, right? And then they set in motion a bunch of policies and that were trying to find common ground to try to get at least pick the low-hanging fruit before they could get to the bigger issues that maybe Obama didn't have control over, like the embargo, like Guantanamo, naval base in Cuba, like democracy and human rights and freedom of speech and such. So I think that a return to that policy is wise. Strategic, slow, maybe. Right now, I think the most pressing thing is humanitarian assistance, humanitarian aid, because of the food shortage, the medicine shortage, and the spike in COVID cases. Those are all important, and I think priorities right now. Other policies that would be, returning to some kind of thaw or re-engagement should come later. I think in general, we should eliminate the embargo. The details about how to do that, when to do that, how much at first or later is important. But I think Obama had the goal, if he was in his power, he would have gotten rid of the embargo. None of this is going to bring freedom to Cuba, but I think it will remove the United States as a convenient scapegoat. It will allow greater people-to-people contacts, economic engagement that could, you know, at least turn Cuba into a China, if not a free country, right? So that there's some more freedom, economic freedoms, there's more prosperity. You know, I mean, many people in Cuba, there's a quote I heard that was really good. It was like, we were so hungry in Cuba that we ate our fear, right? And they didn't have any more fear, so they went out into the streets, right? And I think that that desperation is what's happening in Cuba. And that's partly the design of the embargo, right? To make people desperate so they rise up. So in someone's certainly smiling who supports the embargo right now because they're saying, finally, it's working, and thanks to Trump, right? But I think the price of that is far too high in humanitarian terms to claim it as a victory. And also, it's not clear that that's going to change anything either. So,
do you think the Biden administration will, have the type of policy that you hope the U.S. would take towards Cuba?
Yes. I think it's certainly in the wheelhouse of the Biden administration. They're reviewing that policy, but they're going slow, I think, for three reasons. They're going slow, first of all, because there's a lot of other priorities, huge priorities, starting with COVID, starting with repairing the carnage left by Trump, the American carnage left by the Trump administration, and at least from the perspective of the Democrats, right? So that's number one. Number two is that the Cuban government, instead of reaching across and shaking Obama's hand, they rhetorically, after he left in that state visit in 2016, they attacked his intentions as being, wolf in sheep's clothing. They circled the wagons and tightened the restrictions. They increased repression. So in the short term, the Obama open hand scared them more than the Bush or other presidents' closed fist, because they're used to having an enemy, and they reacted and actually didn't take advantage of this golden historic opportunity to not just normalize relations with the U.S., but take that as an opportunity to change some necessary things within Cuba, even within the structure of the system or the revolution. So that then led a lot of people in South Florida to say, that was a great gesture, that was a great try, Obama, but it didn't work, Trump all the way, right? And that leads me to the third issue, which is South Florida and presidential elections, right? The reason that Biden's not moving quickly on this is that the Democrats lost Florida, and they lost it by a lot relative terms. And it seems very likely, based on exit polling and other kind of surveys, that the Cubans and other Latinos in South Florida who are refugees from repressive leftist countries in Latin America were part of that swing away from the Democrats. There's probably a lot of Latinos and Cubans who voted for Obama and then voted for Trump twice, right? Because when he won and then when he lost the country but won Florida. And that's also for the congressional elections, not just the next presidential election.
Final question. Where do you think we'll be, or where do you think Cuba will be in, 6 months' time? Will the protests have been swept away? Will they have achieved some kind of goal, or will they just be ongoing?
I am not hopeful that things will change for the better rapidly in Cuba. This protest is certainly hopeful in the sense that a massive swath of people who had bitten their tongue and were silent and fearful did take to the streets. And that's a clear warning to the government that it needs to move faster to respond. And unfortunately, the government, at least in the short term, is blaming everything on the U.S. and calling most of the people, scum or traitors or mercenaries. But they also know that this is the most serious threat that they've ever seen in 62 years. And unless they respond to the fundamental issues that are driving it, these protests are going to maybe go underground, be quelled for today and tomorrow, but come back up a month from now, 2 weeks from now, some other spark. If they don't get a hold of COVID, if they don't get get their economic house in order and eliminate some of the scarcities. But none of that's going to happen quickly. The government doesn't move quickly, and it doesn't change these policies. And it's been getting advice after advice after advice from within the country about these things, and it moves extremely slowly. The real question for me is the Cuban people. After this taste of a day of street marches and shouting in the street and losing their fear, are they going to go back and wait again for something to happen? Or are they going to push the issue? When we had a few years ago in Iran, a similar like massive protests, but they ended up being either crushed or, the government outweighed them, repressed them, and then nothing fundamental changed, right? So at this point, it was certainly refreshing. I mean, I have Cuban-American friends who didn't leave Cuba that long ago, who spent the last 2 days crying from shock and happiness and concern and relief, because in their whole lives, they never thought they would see the day. I mean, these kind of things are common in Little Havana in Miami, but they're unheard of largely in Cuba itself. And to see it happen so many places, so many people, is breathtaking. And so it's certainly something to watch, but I can't foresee how in 6 months things will be fundamentally different, but I certainly hope they're moving in that direction.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Ted Henken, thanks for talking to Reason.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. Take care, and we'll keep our eyes on Cuba.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.